More About Co-Housing with Lynn Morstead and Kelly Soika. Co-Housing Houston is a multi-generational, community-minded group of people who share the values of connection and sustainability. We're developing the first co-housing project in Texas, and we're really glad you found us today. Hey, Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
Good
to
you?
see you. I'm very,
good
very
to see
good.
You. Okay, good, because we have a challenging
Yes, I'm on my second cup of caffeine, so
Okay,
I'm ready.
good. I
I'm
hope you
ready
can
for
hear
you.
me. Okay, good.
You always challenge me to go beyond where I would normally be at this time of day.
This one is like by design is challenging. So
Yep.
One of the things that Lynn and I notice as the people who are kind of the front-facing marketing people for Causing Houston is that we are in info sessions and talking to people, and we get some really tough questions that are good questions. So we thought that we would talk about that today. You know, when you are bravely setting out on your first info session and you're talking about all the great things about co-housing, and then, you know, you get stopped in your tracks by some question that you're like, I've never thought about that. Or, so how do you handle that? What do you do? I think that's a good topic.
Well, and I think that it's especially challenging for us coming in from a geography where there is much less known about co-housing.
True,
so
true.
we really are planting the flag here on a new planet. It's called Texas. And we don't have necessarily an audience with the same kind of background as other areas in the country and the same kind of already bought in starting point. So we really are a completely green field, you know, starting from scratch in many cases. And so, you know, the longer that we internally are drinking the Kool-Aid, the more baffled we are by some of these questions, because we become further distanced from our own starting point.
Like, it's hard to remember where you were.
Yeah, like, oh yeah, I used to be really worried about that and wondered about that, but I've kind of moved through all these different stages and I'm kind of beyond that. So I think it's good to go back and collect our questions and kind of refresh. Maybe this will be useful for people who still have those questions or people who are doing these information sessions still.
Yeah. And I want to say too that they're all very valid questions.
Yes.
Like, they're important and you need to ask them, because these are on either side, the person answering the question or the person asking the question, these are your potential neighbors for the next, you know, decades.
Yeah.
So you want to start with a really, you know, strong foundation of being able to be open and honest and ask things that, you know, you might not be in another environment, you might not feel comfortable to be able to bring stuff up like that.
Right, right.
So I'm glad that people have asked us these things in info sessions.
Yep.
And also I'm glad that, you know, you and I have bravely gone forward and figured out how to say things that are truthful for our answers. You know, it'd be easy to blow off somebody's question, but you have
And
to really dig into the truth of it.
Yeah, be straightforward. Yeah. And not be defensive. I think that's something. But anyway, let's just, I mean,
Okay,
speaking
you
of
want to dig
difficult, yeah, just let's
okay,
just
so
go
we
for it.
independently made up lists and then we've just compiled them. But the first one is actually like two sides of the same coin. Mine came up with, people will ask, well, what if I just don't like people in the community? What if I don't like them? And you came up with a slightly different variation on that.
Yeah, because I what I've heard more of is what if people join and then they turned out to be really disruptive or nobody likes them, or how does that work? So, and I mean, I have not lived in community, but the way I answer, certainly the one about people I don't like, what if I don't like people? I say, well, you know, that's the beauty of making a decision about co-housing and the process that we've set up, whereby you become an explorer at first, as opposed to just buying, you know, a house on a street where you know nobody and there's no opportunity to get to know your neighbors in a traditional real estate purchase situation in advance of moving in. So it's really like a huge gamble. You might have terrible neighbors. And I mean,
You
really,
never
it
know.
could be so much worse. And you don't even have any kind of a structure from within which everybody's agreed to have a conversation. And so I think that this one, if you do your due diligence right as a person considering community, we have the pathway laid out for you so that you would not make a decision to move in if you did not like the people that were there.
Yeah. So my answer is a little bit different too. Like, I think of co-housing as kind of like it's an extended friend group. You know, at any given time, some people are going to be at the top of your people you're excited to see, and some people are going to be at the bottom of your list for a while, you know, but it's a moving list. It's not static. You know, somebody does something, you're frustrated, you're annoyed with them. You may not like everybody all the it's actually you probably are not going to like everybody all the time, but what you are going to like is the community as a whole, and you are going to like the entire, you know, friend group or neighbor group that you have. And so people can come and go off the bottom of the list and off the top of the list at any given time, and that's a just kind of a normal part of
I actually have a term for that. I've internalized that as the Kelly co-housing ladder, and people slip up and down that thing. So,
True, it's true. It depends on any given day where people
yeah.
are.
Well, what about if people seem like they're fine, you know, and everybody kind of is able to navigate all this at the beginning, but then they turn out to be terrible and disruptive, like they sort of morph later.
I mean, some people don't stay in co-housing, you know, forever. Like, some people do move in and find out it is not for them. They are not happy, or they have to, you know, make some different decisions in life. And it's a self-selecting group, and some people select out, and that's totally fine because other people will be there for you. It's the community as a whole that is the thing that is going to continue.
Well, I also feel like we are already practicing how to have the difficult conversations. I mean, I've been a party to difficult conversations on both sides of it, where people have, you know, said to me, "I really didn't like that about what you did," or I've had to say the same thing. And I think that the more we practice that muscle, the better able we will be to navigate situations like that. And if somebody really does have a kind of a turnout to be really difficult, I feel now, as I'm learning these skills within the kind of safety net of what we've agreed on, that I will be able to handle that. I mean, I'm hoping and trusting that I will be able to handle that in a much better way than I would be able to in a outside of the co-housing community.
Yeah, or where you just ghost on someone. Because,
Or
yeah.
let it eat me up, which would be
There
more 3 a.m. nasty thoughts. So
you
anyway.
go. Yeah, the things.
Okay. So what's our second one here that we it's see, I feel like we haven't had gotten this lately, but for a while there, this was a really big topic.
Yeah.
Diversity. People were
Yep.
really on it about diversity,
Yep.
all kinds of diversity questions. But what I would observe is that all these diversity questions that people have were very superficial perspectives on diversity. So it might be age, it might be color, it was really along those lines, gender, but it was only the things that you could see at a very superficial level. Nothing was about anything below the surface because they didn't know. And I've heard one of the co-housing experts, Laird Schaub's, talk about this as well. And he was like, "Diverse? Are you kidding? Have you ever been to one of our meetings? Oh my gosh, there is diversity, more diversity popping out of everybody's pores than we can hardly cope with." So, you know, because we deal with each other at a deeper level, you really experience a greater level of diversity in the group.
Yeah, I think that it's a valid question though, particularly if you're somebody who you do not see represented in that group, you know. I think as somebody who has often been on the younger side coming into a group, it's a valid question. Like for me, like if I show up with, you know, a crying 3-year-old at dinner, is that going to be okay? Is it going to be or is that going to be annoying to people? My, you know, kid is it's a real struggle to get that kid to, you know, pick up the toys on the common walk. You know, is this an environment where I'm going to be called to task and it's going to be terrible, or is it going to be an environment where I'm going to be met with compassion? I think for underrepresented voices in our broader society too, that consensus can feel scary because it definitely favors people who think quickly and speak well. And so I think that those are the diversity question is different for different people, and it's more the more useful question to me is, I'm very boisterous. Is that going to work well in this environment? Or I am very reserved. My upbringing was to never, speak up. Is that going to be accepted in the community? Or I live, I have, 19 family members who show up all the time. Is that going to be acceptable in the community?
I
But I
like
think
that.
people don't know how to ask those specific questions, and so then they often just kind of ask under the cover. So I think that the thing that has been the most useful to me is when somebody asks a diversity question is to just, we run through kind of the stats of our group of like what ages and types of households are represented and people's, nationality or we kind of run through that stuff. But once we're past the facts of it, I think it is really useful to ask people why, what does that mean to them and why? And are they looking at diversity because they're looking to be a part of something that looks different than their current friend group or current group? Or are they asking the diversity question for themselves because they wonder how they fit in? So I think
I like that, Kelly. That's really good.
it's helpful.
Well, that kind of leads into the next question that we have on our list, you
Yeah, this
know?
is one that I get a lot that you say that you don't really feel like you get that much, but I feel like sometimes people come in with a really like they've read some books and they've decided that this is the way a community should be. And so I'm gonna say sociocracy, though I'm just using it as an example because it's definitely not, it's a valid question, like, does your group use sociocracy? But sometimes we'll get people who are like, why doesn't your group use, blah blah, or why doesn't your group do this thing? Why doesn't your group use sociocracy? I have decided that sociocracy is the way to go. Why doesn't your group do that? And it's a challenging question because it's a valid question if they're asking for information about it, about like what's the history, how has your group gotten to where they are. But it's a challenging question if it's being asked because the person has a very fixed mindset of what community looks like or should look like. Because really, community is the people who are there in that community. And if that group doesn't want to do, one thing, then that group's not going to do that one thing. So, and with new members, the group changes. So it's difficult to me to kind of walk that line of, hey, community's made up of who's here. If you were here and you felt really strongly about it, the community would listen to you. And, if you were able to articulate why this really is the best and it really is, then I'm sure the community will adopt whatever the thing is.
I think that's good. And actually, I think the thing that I can relate to a little bit on that is that I think you're right. People sort of show up with it if they have a little bit more knowledge, with kind of a preconceived template of what we are putting into place, and we're just filling it in, but it's going to operate within this very specific construct. And they don't really get the power that this group has to make it the way this group wants. It's really hard for them to grasp that.
But then sometimes that's asked, do you remember we had the guy who wanted to live off the land and what wanted to have a zero emission home and wanted to have income sharing. I don't know if you recall that guy, but he came in and he asked very kind of the same kind of questions, like very specific questions about like why didn't our group have income sharing, or why doesn't our group, have like we've got a very strong urban sustainability message and decision making and elements that we've built in, but we're not on like 40 acres in the middle of America. We're in an urban city.
Oh, you know, I know who you're talking about, but
Yeah,
I
so
wasn't at that session, so
yeah, I mean, it was helpful, honestly, for hey, this is not for you.
Yeah.
You there are communities for you. You should go find them. But this just isn't it. So it's a good place.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a good point, Kelly, because one of the things that I think I certainly started out doing this work was thinking that I need to present some sort of a picture that would be acceptable for everybody that showed up, as opposed to saying, okay, this is how we are shaping ourselves. You show up and you want something different. That's fine. This may
Yeah.
not be for you. And I think that was, getting used to saying that word or that phrase has been a learning for me, to say, well, maybe this is just not for you. Kind of like, wow, that was pretty shocking for me the first time I was able to say that, which seems strange, but it's so obvious, Okay, so what's our next one?
Our next one is gentrification, the gentrification question.
Yes, yes,
Which
yes.
I think we particularly face it. I think a lot of housing groups face it, but we particularly face it
Yeah.
because we're in an urban environment with a lot of neighbors. If we were, had a ton of space and not a lot of neighbors, I'm not sure that it would.
Well, and there's also, yes, a big disparity between, our socioeconomic group and the majority of our neighbors. So, are we taking advantage of low land prices? Yes, actually, we are.
This is what we could afford.
So the good news, however, I feel like that we can actually speak to pretty confidently is that we are infill. We are not tearing down anybody's home. We are not displacing anybody. We are removing, in fact, a pretty horrible eyesore in the community. It was this bunker thing that was falling apart and was really, ready for demolition. So we took care of that demolition and we're putting something that's in place that's much more beautiful. I think the other good news story that we've done, and I have not heard of other co-housing groups who've done that. Maybe you have in some of your work, Kelly, but we started 2 years ago a neighborhood engagement group that has really made some remarkable forays into the community, established new relationships, gotten involved in the civic association, and even just this fall, been voted onto a local commune there. Every in HISD, Houston Independent School District, each one of the public schools has a committee that is a mix of community members, parents, administrators that serves as kind of a board over the school. And one of our members has been voted into that board group, even in advance of us moving in there. So we've really tried to position ourselves to be really involved in the community in a meaningful way, as opposed to just dropping in, parachuting in, and driving in and out of our place and just, ignoring what's happening around us. We
Do
really,
you
really,
feel like the important thing for groups to do is to to take that question as a note? Like you need to be doing something
Well, if you care, you
if
might
you're
not care.
concerned. If you care, and then factually reflect back what you're doing.
Yeah,
And I
yeah.
mean, there are two sides to that of the ability to point to what you've actually done, and then also to acknowledge that this is something that the co-housing group felt needed to be done.
Right. Well, and it connected to our values. I mean, we've really, if you might boil down after all that discussion of 999 values, we've really boiled it down is the essence of it is connections and sustainability. And connections is we're not just trying to do that inside our internal community, but also with our neighbors at large. And I think finding ways to really take action on that aspiration has been remarkable what the neighborhood engagement group has done. And I mean, really, but one person has really led out, and that's Margie. It's been fantastic. So,
Well,
that.
so the next question that we get is when this actually kind of relates back to your it's not for everyone. So sometimes people come in with just things you can't change. I guess they're tough questions because there's really just nothing to say about it.
It's
Or
right.
people come in and they'll be like, oh, I thought they were going to be, we're stacked flats. And like, oh, I thought they were going to be separate homes. And
Yeah,
you're like,
nope.
well, they're not.
Yeah, I know. And I really have to be really quite careful not to say, like, Really, you thought we were going to have 33 separate homes on 1.5 acres inside the city?
That
Interesting.
look
Interesting. Yeah. What would that look like? But that also kind of links back to, like, I've had people say to me, why aren't you doing tiny homes? Because we're just not, you know,
Because we
like
just
that's
aren't.
not, we just aren't. So, you know, thanks for visiting us.
I guess that's the thing, is that some of these tough questions, it's also, sometimes I think people, rightly so, are asking questions to see if they can trust the answers and to see if they can trust, because they're, this is the beginning of a trusting relationship, right, with your neighbors. And so you need to be able to ask questions and have confidence in the answers that you're getting,
Right.
the
That you're
ability.
not just getting fluffed off.
Yeah, exactly. That people care about the things
Yeah.
you care about, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you really care about living in individual homes, then
Yeah.
sorry, co-housing is not for you. But
Yeah.
if you're like, why didn't you know, why
Yeah.
aren't they individual homes? Then being able to explain and talk about the history of like how we wound up where we did, is that's relationship building. I think that's important.
Right. Oh, I love that you highlight that, because I was just thinking about the difference between, let's pretend I was a realtor and I was trying to sell you on this place. I would be pivoting at you into all these different directions, trying to distract you from that thing and
Right.
have you focus on the positive instead of just meeting you exactly where you are and saying, I get it. Yeah, maybe this is not for you.
Yeah.
And that's a very different approach and builds a different kind of a foundation for relationship. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, talk, speaking of things that we just can't do much about, this is the PPSF question.
Our price per
Per
square foot.
square foot. Yes.
Why is it so expensive?
Yes,
I
yes,
mean,
yes.
I feel like maybe realtors get this a lot too. I don't know. I don't know if this is a question that happens everywhere, or if it is acutely a co-housing question, because the co-housing group has made the decisions to purchase the land where it is, which costs, X dollars, and to build it the way that it's being built, which costs Y dollars. And therefore must charge Z, because X plus Y divided by the number of units is going to equal Z. And that is just the way that it is. And so it's hard, I think, to, when people ask that question, again, I feel like that's a question that is a surface one that's hiding some other questions. For example, I only value making, a financial decision that is going to make me money with an ROI within the next 2 years. Okay, that's a different question. Then ask
Right.
us that,
Yeah. But I think it's also, remember us talking about us being kind of, you know, putting this stake in the sand here in Texas, that the mentality around real estate purchase is very much what where you led out with, you know, return on investment. It is an investment. It is not an emotional decision. That's what where people are sort of trained to think about. And, you know, co-housing, you're buying a lifestyle. You're not buying a piece of real estate that is going to provide investment. And these same people who are asking me this are people who might pay huge money for other things, which are very, very expensive that I would never consider. Like, I don't know, the top floor, some senator lounge, you know, ocean view on a cruise, you know, to the Caribbean. Like, no, thank
Is
you.
that a term, the senator lounge?
I don't know.
We're like making stuff up
I'm
here.
making stuff up now. Yeah. I
Or
bet you
like
there is
cars.
one.
I think
Yeah.
about
Or
like,
cars, right? Yeah.
why do you drive this
Perfect.
car versus
You're
that car?
driving this really
What's gonna get you
expensive
there?
car. Yeah. That costs all this money. And I'm in my 10-year-old Ford that is the door smashed in. It rains inside now because that's where I'm putting my money in co-housing instead of my car, you know? So I think that it's, if we can get them to think about the fact that this is a different kind of a decision, it's not a traditional real estate decision, and it's kind of a break away from that, then I think it's much easier for them to embrace the price per square foot.
The other
But
thing I
it
think it's helpful to point out is that co-housing, in general, particularly new builds, are intentionally smaller. I mean, it's
yes.
intentionally smaller than other forms of, this like explosion in square footage for American housing. Like, I just heard that the average size of an American house is approaching 3,000 square feet. That's average. Like, that's crazy. How is that
I know.
possible? You know, and so then, you know, you look at our co-housing lifestyle where it's intentionally smaller. You don't need as many things. It's very countercultural for people. And you have to just have a different, you have to really value the community that living in a smaller space forces you to have. You know, you have to use a common house because you need,
You don't have
you know, a
room.
bigger room to do things or whatever, you know, and you don't buy as many things, which is a it's buying things is fun, it's pleasant, you know. And so to say to people like we're intentionally living smaller so that you don't have to acquire as many things, it's there's a lot built into that price per square footage. Not really a number, it's a whole discussion.
It is, but they can't that has not ever been in the past for them, if a part of the selection process. So this is, it's like moving into a new plane, a new paradigm
Maybe
around
that's the
how.
hard part, Lynn, is like making getting a question that somebody's expecting a number, and instead they get a paragraph or an essay.
Like,
That's
I'm gonna do a mind shift on you. You know, you're coming in from this paradigm. We're gonna be, you know, we're moving to the, instead of all bicycles have a seat that is a contiguous, you know, flat thing, we're moving to that bicycle that has two little things. Have you seen those? It's like two split slivers that you sit on. Like, we're moving into, it's a paradigm shift. Okay, so speaking of paradigm shifts, we have some unknowable scenarios, right, that people ask us about.
And this one I think is tough. It's a little bit easier for me because I've lived in co-housing, so I can at least like pull examples of how things have worked. But the two that we're thinking of are consensus takes too long. It takes a long time to make a decision. And then participation, that like, oh, what if people don't participate, or what if, you know, what if? But these are like the what if, you know, situations of I don't honestly know how co-housing Houston is going to, are we going to be, am I ever going to feel in a meeting like, oh my gosh, our decision making is slow? Probably. Am I ever going to complain that there's not enough participation? Definitely. You know, always. Like, but is it going to be enough to be frustrating to me, or to does the, you know, to the sense of community is going to outweigh that frustration for me? Yes. But I can only say yes because I've lived in community, so.
Well, I have slightly different take on the slow decisions. I think, based on my, you know, we've talked about this a lot, is that I still really hang on to a conversation we had with a guy at Tacoma Village co-housing in DC, who had came from a world of consensus decision making, grew up in a Quaker and friend's house experience, Quaker college, and he then entered into the corporate world. And I really, really think about this a lot when I feel like our decision making is feels slow. What he talked about is that he believes that the entire life cycle of a decision, from conception to being fully adopted and bought in by a group of people, is the same. It's just that with consensus decision making, it is all front end loaded, and the little piece at the end with the implementation and buy-in is very small. And having made a lot of money at ExxonMobil in my career working on the front end piece of this, the back end piece, I should say, because the front end piece goes very fast in a hierarchical organization. A bunch of guys in a small room make a bunch of decisions. They come out of the door, they shout down the chain, everybody down the chain starts working on it. And then there's this piece at the end where it takes forever to implement it. People are resisting it. They didn't want it. It doesn't meet their needs. Nobody asked them if this would work for their particular scenario in their business line, but it's all forced down from above. So I really feel like, if you take it from, again, from, you know, inception all the way to kind of fully bought in, it is entirely possible that it's the exact same length, but it feels different because we're just not used to that. Again, it's one of these paradigm shifts. If you want to get to full, and you've often used this word, Kelly, which really sticks with me, durable decisions. You talk about the longer we spend making sure that we take care of everybody's input, of everybody's concerns, by the time you get to implementation, it's durable. You're not having resistance. You're not having second guessing. You're not having redo of things. It sticks. You stick the landing. And that I feel really good about that. So whenever I catch myself being a little impatient, I think this is good. We're getting to that solidity on this thing.
Yeah.
It
The other
feels good.
thing that, as you talk through that, is that in a hierarchical decision making, this is actually for both slow decisions and participation, that in other scenarios, so like in a regular HOA, the decisions are quick, they're quickly made, and you're surprised by them often in the form of a bill. And there's low participation. Very few people are making decisions for a whole big group of people. However, and your input is quick. You vote, right? So you vote and that's it. It's quick. And your personal participation is also little. Your one household doesn't, your vote's unlikely to sway things. But in co-housing, your ability and your access to participate is huge. You can participate in everything that's going on, basically. You have a huge ability to participate. And you have a huge ability to weigh in on the decision. So whether or not you choose to do that, you may not, you may decide like, I don't care if dinners are at 6 or at 7, does not matter to me. So you can opt out of it. You don't have to do that. But the people who need to be in the room will be in the room making those decisions. But again,
No,
it's
I.
one of those questions that's like unknowable, and it goes out to kind of
Yeah.
philosophical.
Well, and I just want to say one more thing about participation. We've had some conversations about participation. In fact, we'll have an episode on that here at some point. We were talking about the fact that a lot of participation, I think, is difficult in communities that don't actually live together because it's sort of invisible. So you might be, I mean, in your HOA, it would be different, but sometimes because of the way the buildings are structured, you may not actually intersect with each other very much. You don't run into each other in the same way, but because of the architectural design, which is designed for connections, we will be having much more visibility of each other's lives and our connections. So, when somebody today sends out an email to everybody in the group, say, "Hey, you want to participate in this?" Well, two things can happen. One is they don't see the email, or two, they say, they do see the email and they decide to, yes, I'll participate or not. But then what happens is, like, we had an incident yesterday with one of our dear members who was so excited about participating in something last night. And I texted her this morning and said, "Is everything okay? I was worried about you." And she said, "I just forgot." And I'm like, that would never happen if we were living next to each other. So just the proximity will increase participation in ways that I think, as a person who's never lived like that, and would be coming with that question, you can't even imagine how that's going to be. It's like in a dorm in college. If you've been in a dorm and a corridor in college, it's pretty rare that something's going on down the hall that you don't know about and you don't have an opportunity to be a part of. Whereas if everybody is then afterwards living in separate apartments off campus, you miss out on stuff.
Yeah, it's harder. So maybe one of the things that maybe one of the like tips for difficult questions is to, state kind of the facts of whatever the answer is, but then also ask people to relate that question back to other parts of their lives. Because that's an accessible on-ramp for people who are considering co-housing but haven't lived in it. They're considering it for a reason. And so there must be something in their background or in their lives that where these things have come up before, and how was it handled, and how would they like that to be handled, and have they lived in close proximity with other people, or Okay, so then our last one is what
Last one.
you came up with that you've heard.
Yeah, so this is so my the question that I've heard a lot is, well, I already have a great community where I live. What is so different about this? And I think there's a couple of things to that. One thing that I tell people is that, yes, I have had periods in my life where I lived was really great. There was a lot of interaction with the neighbors, et cetera. But then the neighbors moved, and the new person who moved in, they didn't have that same sense about how we related, because again, we had no kind of formal structure into which they were moving, which would support us having a continued relationship. So it's if you have that today where you live, and it's great, fantastic, just enjoy the heck out of it and go for it, But it might change in the future. Whereas I feel like in co-housing, it's more structured,
Yes,
And the other thing is that I just feel like We sort of put this wrapper around this concept, and I think people are worried that we've got this shiny wrapping paper with a pretty bow, and it all sort of looks different. And maybe when they unpack it and open the box, it's the same damn thing as they're living in today. Hey, you snookered me into this, and it's the same thing. So I don't know. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, I point to, there are a lot of resources out there from like cohousing.org, and Shelley Parks in particular has done some really fantastic work recently about what it's like to move in. She had not lived in cohousing before and she moved into cohousing, and to talk about, the ephemeral parts of being in community with people. I think that I usually point people in that direction of just like you won't know until you're there. It takes an act of faith to move in with a group of people and decide that you're going to be an active community together. I mean, it takes an act of faith for sure. But I also think, again, to go back to your, it's not for everybody. If you have a great community and a great sense of community, by all means, hold on to that because it's important. And a lot of people in the US don't have that. So keep that up. I feel like that's.
Exactly. So come call on us again when all that disappears.
Exactly. Well, I hope this
Okay.
was helpful to
Yes.
somebody somewhere, because I think that, forming causing communities, it takes a lot of effort to get the word out. And sometimes you just run into stuff that is difficult. So here you go, difficult questions.
Yeah, tough questions. Okay. Well, bye and send us some tough questions. Maybe we can talk about it for you.
That'd be a great idea. Thanks, all.
Bye.
Thanks for stopping by today. We're so glad you clicked on our episode. For more information about our project, Cohousing Houston, go to www.cohousinghouston.com and subscribe to our newsletter. For general information about cohousing, we like cohousing.org. We're active on social media, so check out what's happening on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under Cohousing Houston.